Our next speaker, Lou Branscombe, has had a remarkable career in academia, in the government, and in industry. His career was launched by collaborating with Tom Lehrer while a student at Harvard University. That propelled him into NIST, then the National Bureau of Standards, where he rapidly became the director and played an important role in the founding of JILA, for which I'm personally grateful because that's a leading institution in atomic physics and is due in large to Lou's vision at the time. After working at NBS, he became the chief researcher at IBM. What was the?
Chief scientist was chief the title, scientist. But I was actually the chief technologist.
Okay, so as the chief scientist.
Because we had a research director.
Yes, at IBM, and helped make that lab one of this stellar constellation of labs that we now so sadly miss in this country. He served on PCAST, and he is currently professor emeritus at Harvard University, where he has been in the Kennedy School for a number of years on issues of science policy. So, Lou.
Thank you, Dan. Both Jack and Neil, among other things, made occasional and important references to public attitudes about science. And let me just say that yesterday, trying to fly here from the West Coast, which I finally managed to do by getting an airplane that was an hour and a half late to connect in San Francisco with an airplane that was 2 hours late that got me here. I was sitting by a man with no scientific training who is in fact a flight attendant the last 11 years for United, who's very excited. He had a brother who works at Fermilab. And this brother had called him up on the phone in great excitement and said, "We have made this fabulous discovery. We found this particle. It only exists for just a tiny moment, but it's going faster than the speed of light." And I said to myself, my first thought was, isn't this fabulous? This flight attendant guy is all excited just because his brother did something in science. My second thought was, maybe I should be a bit upset that he wasn't deterred by this suggestion that this vanishing particle was going faster than the speed of light. And my third conclusion was, well, actually, it doesn't make any difference at all why he thinks that science is exciting. And just because he's got the wrong reason is really irrelevant. So part of what I'm going to talk about is whether it really matters, whether the public understands the fundamentals or not, and what the rest of us have to do about it. Well, let me, since this is supposed to be a little symposium on science policy, I felt the debt to sort of say where it starts from, but not really all the way back. But clearly, before World War II, science was largely dependent through remuneration for teaching and a few private foundations. There were some government labs like the Bureau of Standards and the Coast Survey and the Geological Survey that go way back, but they were small. This time, if you go to the spring meeting of the American Physical Society, I think it's still on materials, there'll be 5,000 or 6,000 people there. Well, there was a spring meeting in the American Physical Society when I went to work at the Bureau of Standards in 1951, and they met in the second floor room of the East Building at the National Bureau of Standards, and all 50 scientists who attended the spring meeting of the APS fit very comfortably into this room. Now, in the last half century, of course, largely thanks to the contributions of applied science to winning World War II and the vision of people like Vannevar Bush, and indeed the threat posed by the Soviet Union, our government became deep pockets source of support for science. And at first, many academic science departments, I knew several, were deeply suspicious of the government as a sponsor, fearing constraints on their intellectual freedom and perhaps even more severe uncertainties about whether the research would have any continuity, the research support. But research at universities under the leadership of people like Fred Terman at Stanford soon saw the opportunity and took the risk to build their engineering and science programs around soft government money. Government saw science as means for sustaining its military prowess. In 1960, you may not believe it, but the United States Department of Defense funded a full 33% of all the R&D funded in the Western world, the countries now comprising OECD, including the United States. Thus, a marriage was consummated by two partners, science and politics, who needed each other, but for quite different and, to some degree, conflicting motives. In our democracy, the relationship between science and politics has never been easy. But in the minds of the drafters of the Constitution, it was always important. The search for truth in science and for legitimacy in politics both require systems for generating trust. But these systems are not the same, and they are often incompatible. The most profound area of mismatch between science and politics is found not in conflicts over how much research is deserving of public funding, but rather in conflicts over advice government receives from scientific and technical experts on important but primarily non-technical matters of policy. Thus, as Harvey Brooks once famously said, it's not over policy for science so much that the conflicts arise, but over science for policy. It's no accident that the democratic America fostered progress in science and technology perhaps more than any other nation. Democracy and science stand to benefit enormously when our political leaders understand that the traditions of science and the mechanics of democracy have common roots. Both American democracy and modern science are products of the Enlightenment, with its emphasis on reason and openness rather than on religious and political authority. American democracy has always benefited from a pragmatic willingness to learn from experience, very much as science relies on experiment. Progress in science is based on transparency, accountability, and trust. These are also the basic principles of sustainable democratic government. Thus, if science and democracy are both to flourish, government must be pragmatic, open, and viewed by the voters as legitimate and responsive to voter desires. If science is corrupted by government, government itself is in danger of becoming corrupt. And conversely, when government allows itself to become corrupt, science advice is sure to suffer as well, as is science. In recent years, we seem to have been going down that treacherous path. During the recent political campaign, presidential candidate Obama promised to reverse the trend. He and many media commentators spoke often of a new pragmatism as his guiding principle for governance. As president, Obama's off to a very good start, as has already been mentioned, having appointed exceptionally well-qualified scientists to top posts in his government and having initiated many of the changes he promised. But that leaves a major question unanswered. If government is to depend on science for practical advice on policy choices, it is not enough for the politicians to be pragmatic and be prepared to listen to the independent advice of the best experts. Having listened to science, they must now find support from the public for the policies they put forward. But for the voting public to understand and support these choices, it must have some understanding of the technical basis for political decisions. If the voters are ignorant of technical matters, how can they evaluate the performance of government officials and thus establish the legitimacy of their governance? Science must therefore not only give wise advice to government, but must also find a way to share our understanding of the factual basis for policy choices with the public. Thus, if we are to preserve the legitimate and accountable democracy envisioned by the authors of the Constitution and enjoy the fruits of an intelligent, informed society, government must be responsive to a well-informed voting public, and science, and by the way, also the media, must more effectively share what we know with the public. But how well informed is the public? The Public Agenda, a nonprofit research organization founded in 1975 by Dan Yankelovich and Cy Vance, has been studying that question for a long time. They began more recently by asking what the public knows and thinks about energy policy. We'll just use this as an example. The Public Agenda recently released a new study entitled The Energy Learning Curve. Here are some of their findings as summarized on the Public Agenda website. PublicAgenda.com gets it for you. There is significant common ground in public thinking on what the nation should do about energy. The public also thinks our energy challenge is here to stay. Three quarters, mind you, of the public believes we should move toward increased use of alternative energy, even if fuel prices go down, unquote. The study identified 10 proposals on alternative energy, energy efficiency, and cutting gasoline use. These 10 have support from more than two-thirds of the public, all 10. A strong majority approved providing tax benefits to individuals and businesses who reduce energy consumption, 81% and 79% respectively. 78% approved increasing gas mileage requirements and would reward businesses that reduce carbon emissions and penalize those that do not. Some 86% agreed either strongly or somewhat strongly that investing in alternative energy will create many new jobs. Nearly 7 in 10, 68%, want the nation to take steps to gain energy independence even if it raises costs. Now, there's a well-informed public for you. But the report also found equally widespread agreement, I must say, on some ideas that from the public's point of view are off the table. People don't want to be pushed, unquote, the report found, and they don't want to do anything that increases the cost of driving. There was strong opposition to all options of that kind. Gas taxes to fund development of renewable energy sources, 53% are against that. Taxes to help achieve energy independence, 47% don't like it. Setting minimum prices for gas, 72%. Or congestion pricing to force people to change their driving habits, 61%. Even so, the report continues, the cost of fuel and dependence on foreign oil remain the public's biggest concern about energy. Nearly 9 in 10, 89%, say they worry about price increases, and 57% who worry a lot. Concern about dependence on foreign oil is almost as high at 83%. 47% worry a lot about that. Climate change is lower in the public's priorities list. While 71% say they worry about global warming, only 32% say they worry about it a lot. Public worry about global warming ranks 25 points less than those who worry about prices. But what's particularly interesting is the contrast between the large majorities in favor of policies that the technical community would also support, and the frailty of the public scientific understanding on which these convictions rest. Thus, the study goes on to say, quote, but there are reasons to wonder how well this consensus would stand up under pressure. Our research, the study says, shows that the public does not know critical facts about the problem. Half of all Americans, 51%, could not correctly identify a renewable energy source, such as solar or wind power. 39% couldn't even name a fossil fuel. 65% overestimated U.S. dependence on Middle East oil, and 52% thought that by reducing smog, the United States has come a long way to addressing global warming. Could it be, then, that lack of understanding of the most basic relevant technical facts is at least in part responsible for the public's unwillingness to accept any policy that increases the cost of driving, even though nearly 7 in 10 want the nation to, quote, take steps to gain energy independence even if it raises costs? Dan Yankelovich concludes that the state of public education is such that science cannot rely on telling the public what we think they need to know. We cannot depend on well-intentioned programs of public science literacy or public understanding of science. We must partner Yankelovich believes, with government in a major effort to upgrade public education at all levels and to partner with them in helping them explain to the public what those basic scientific facts are. We must also face the fact that some people are nervous about direct democracy as the right principle of the public's role in policy for science, if not in science for policy. For example, Donna Girardi Riordan expressed such reluctance in Issues in Science and Technology last summer under the title, Research Funding Via Direct Democracy, Is It Good for Science? To be sure, the Founding Fathers had little problem with direct democracy, since in their day, the voters were mostly landed, well-educated white men, a small fraction of the population. Today, we must carry out the basic ideas of the Enlightenment in a society that must link the entire voting public with both the elite, the specialists and the experts, and the empowered, the government officials. Science policy and accountable democratic governance do not depend only on a good relationship between science and politics. In reality, it depends on a triangle comprised of political institutions, the community of experts, and the voting public. When one examines science policy literature, most of it is about science advice and science integrity in government. They are important, but the scientists' concern for the role of the voting public leg of that triangle is particularly weak. That role has been left largely to a fourth player, the media. How well does the media help scientists inform the public and help the public learn from science and use that knowledge to evaluate the quality of political governance? Dan Yankelovich parses the role of the media's role in public policy in three stages. For important emergent issues such as energy policy, the first stage in the media's role is consciousness raising about what the issues are. Yankelovich gives the media good marks for this role in public education. The second stage, working through these issues, is where the media falls short. This is the stage where sorting out the facts and the evidence they rest on is more important. Here, the media performs badly. The third stage, Yankelovich calls implementation. He thinks the media do okay here, since this is the phase of political consensus development, which rests on the public to politics link, where the media are more comfortable. Thus, there are weaknesses in all three legs of the triangle, and the media do not adequately compensate for the weakness in the relation between science and the public, or between science and politics. So what is the prospect for building a stronger, more rational society given the complexities and weaknesses in the current system of governance and the public participation that validates it? The task seems daunting, but one can list at least four of the main challenges. First, through reform of the election process and lobbying rules, weaken the dependence of politics on moneyed interests and replace special interest politics with greater dependence on public evaluation and approval. Second, include in the education of scientists, engineers, and other experts the skills to communicate with the voting public and enhance their sense of obligation to do so. The technical community must also take greater interest in the public issues to which their work is relevant and the channels through which expert knowledge informs both the public and the political decisions. Three, reduce the concentration of ownership in the media. Recognize the power of the internet to replace traditional channels and enhance the incentive of all media channels to do a better job of working through the issues. That is, to help the public and the politicians understand the facts and the unknowns on which sound public policy must rest. Four, as one component of government funding of research, in addition to pure science and applied research, establish funding for Jeffersonian science, a phrase invented by Jerry Holton, and some people don't like it because they don't like the fatherhood of Mr. Jefferson, but that's a little irrelevant. Jefferson, after all, did publish, while he was in the White House, an article using the calculus to design a better shape for a steel plow and it was published in a peer-reviewed journal. And I think that gives Jefferson the right to have his name attached to a science policy. Anyway, so Jeffersonian science, which by which we mean long-term creative research that may be relevant to society's most difficult challenges. Government should identify these grand challenges, as Mr. Obama indeed has been doing, and provide funding for unsolicited proposals to explore new ideas for increasing options for making these goals easier to understand and solve. A key requirement here is the availability of high levels of expertise and good judgment in both government and available to government. So let me explain just for a moment what back in 2001, before this effort was sort of cut off by Osama bin Laden, what we mean by Jeffersonian science or how it might work. Top scientists in the executive branch, and by the way, after a major workshop on this subject back in 2001, 100 scientists signed on the inside cover of the monograph that describes this, their general acquiescence to this being a reasonable idea. Both of them are sitting in the front row along with John Holdren and a lot of other people. So there was a pretty good consensus on the basic idea. The top scientists in executive branch agencies responsible for achieving a new energy economy or advances in medicine that reduce cost and improve public health or reversing nuclear weapons proliferation and so forth would put in place the applied and engineering work that can be accelerated today. That, of course, they're already doing. That's the applied research. But they would also commission panels of experts for each goal who would identify the lively areas of basic science where new ideas might dramatically accelerate the applied and engineering progress. In these areas, agencies such as DOE, NSF, and NIH would fund those unsolicited proposals in the identified disciplinary areas, or even cross-disciplinary areas. The funded scientists would not expect to become experts in the applied national goal, and if their work didn't turn out to be relevant to the goal, no matter, they're doing great basic research. Their work would be measured, however, by the quality of the science, like the more traditional Newtonian basic science. My prediction is that these scientists come into contact with others who are funded through this same mechanism. They would quickly become knowledgeable about the possibilities of breakthrough discoveries that do accelerate achievement of the grand challenge goals. So how well is the Obama administration likely to address these four issues I named? And I'll very briefly summarize that. The administration is committed to tackling number one, reforming politics. However, the intent is there, but so far the bipartisan cooperation has not emerged. That's an understatement. There is not yet explicit commitment to number two, motivating scientists to take more seriously their obligations to inform the public. But Obama's new pragmatism approach surely implies the need to do this. In addition, there's evidence that the technical professional societies, including APS, are taking the issue more seriously. Indeed, the annual meeting of the AAAS next February will be in my hometown in San Diego and focused on this issue. As yet, we've heard very little about item three, media reform, except for the government's authority to put legal restraints on anti-competitive concentrations of media channel ownership. This reform has to be left to the media organizations themselves and the publics they serve. Media objectivity and independence are essential to democracy, however, as is their capacity to work through complex technical issues. The good news is that applying basic science to society's grand challenges, with energy, health, education, policy at the top of the list, is a serious commitment. The president has set out the domestic grand challenge priorities, and he has said to the annual meeting of the National Academy that he's depending on science to help the nation make rapid progress on each. He has also made a dramatic commitment on research resources, quote, "We will devote more than 3% of our GDP to research and development." Now John Holdren, Steve Chu, Jane Lubchenco, and others will be able to design the process that we call Jefferson Science 8 years ago as they carry out the bottoms-up research funding in support of the top-down, presidentially defined grand challenges. And how they do that remains to be seen, but if it all works out, Perhaps this mode of applying the best and most long-range science thinking to the nation's most urgent goals will be called Obamian science. Given the high quality and leadership skills of the Obama scientific appointees, I'm hopeful they can also help energize the scientific community to seize the occasion to introduce a more rational, enlightened approach to solving our problems, both domestic and global. And while we have a terrific team of technical leaders named for key roles in government, it is rather as though we citizen voters, watching from the bleachers, are just now seeing our players come out of the tunnel onto the field. How will our smarter, more energetic team, with a terrific new coach, fare against the traditional opposition of the really big players, from entrenched interests, ideological foes of scientific knowledge, and those who want instant gratification? The outcome of the game is not certain, but our team has its eye on the late fourth quarter and deserves wholehearted support from its fans. If they win, I'm sure the Founding Fathers would be proud. Thank you.
So here are many thoughts to think about. Are there questions?
Yes. Well, the newspapers are in trouble right now. Do you think we should start advocating, and if so, how, that there should be a science reporter on each newspaper?
Well, the newspapers have to survive for there to be science reporters. And so far, the best of the newspapers that are in trouble, such as the New York Times, which is in trouble, desperately trying to get a big price for the Boston Globe so the Times can stay in business, I have not at all diminished their Tuesday Science supplement. So I think the newspaper editors are doing the best they possibly can to keep the science in the program. I don't know what we can do to solve the newspapers. The problem is not that people don't read newspapers, it's that advertisers don't advertise in them anymore. My own solution lies in the hands of Amazon Corporation, which will sell you the Kindle book device. Now, Kindle may be very good as a book device, but it has 38 of the nation's absolutely top newspapers available on it for a relatively modest sum. I think it's $9.90 a month or something like that. And if, in fact, then they would just make the Kindle a little bit bigger physically and make a few other changes, here's a marriage between internet and computer technology and newspapers that might, in fact, emerge as the alternative. I don't know. I do know that, of course, blogs and advertising on internet channels has, in part, eaten into the newspapers and is a whole new avenue for scientific citizens as well as citizens interested in science to have their voice heard in an accessible place, made accessible by Google and Yahoo and others. But unfortunately, that particular avenue doesn't have the kinds of quality control that a really good newspaper editing system will attempt to provide. How that will emerge, I don't know. I mean, Wikipedia fans and unfans argue a lot about the issue of quality control in Wikipedia, although you can find a Wikipedia about anything, virtually anything. So we're at the early stage, I think, of seeing a transformation between print information and electronic information. So far, the electronic information is taking over, but not necessarily with quality.
I mean, a concern that I have is that the electronic media is basically devoted to entertainment, and that news is treated as entertainment now. And in such a circumstance, it's really very difficult to wonder how we will have this thoughtful, enlightened public that you were talking about.
On the other hand, if you just talk about political information, the electronic media do give you the full spread of opinions. And if you are really a good citizen, you will listen to Fox News and you will read their blogs and find out what the other half is thinking. If you're not, you will listen to CSNBC and have fun listening to Rachel Maddow.
You're asking a lot from us there.
Yeah. Yes.
Are there? Yes.
So, still on the subject of newspapers, I personally think they're maybe giving historically a little too much credit for quality control. At one point, you used the magic word objective. My impression reading newspapers in the last 10, 15 years is that in the eye of the newspaper, there is no such thing as an actual fact. There is only what people say. The reporter calls someone, and someone says,
"Oh yeah,"
and
that's a very important principle of good journalism, because otherwise, what reason would you have to believe the opinion of this newspaper when he's reporting that the Higgs boson has been discovered?
But if the newspaper quotes someone who says energy is conserved and quotes someone else who says energy is not conserved, no one reading the newspaper can learn anything.
Yeah.
I don't see that this is going
But I think the science report, I was really thinking of the Tuesday science section in the Times. I think those people do a good job, by and large. Occasionally you find an error, but most of those errors are because they have to be very brief, or they haven't got time to talk to everybody, one or the other. Yes?
When it comes to science or policy, isn't part of the problem in Washington that there's too much advice, that you have countless advisory committees, literally thousands and thousands of reports.
Yeah.
Part of the challenge is managing and coordinating and making sense of all of that advice.
Harvey Brooks, indeed, used to said in print more than once that in comparative science policy of U.S. and other nations, that the United States government receives more science advice than any other country in the world and listens to it less, because there's so many. Nevertheless, most of that, I mean, first of all, if you just look numerically at the number of advisory boards and committees and commissions, they're a very large number, but a very large hunk of them are either devoted to something very narrow and local and significant locally in the government, that is, advising NIST on whether they're doing a good job in chemistry or not, and things like that, which is important to do, but doesn't shake the nation fundamentals. Or they are quite specific to a task to be done that's really important. If you read Sheila Jasanoff's book, The Fifth State, I think it was called. That book is really an analysis of the statutory committees that exist both in FDA and in the EPA, which are required by law whenever the administrator is about to issue a regulation. Those committees are required to evaluate the technical basis for that regulation and to report whether they believe it's based on sound science. Now, they have no control. If the administrator wants to issue it anyway, even though they say it's based on bad science, not much you can do about it except the law says that report has to be published. Now, that to me is a really good example of institutionally structuring an advisory process that has a real job to do, and yet it doesn't take over the political accountability that the president and his agency head have. And so there are a fair number like that. And I think, by and large, where those committees are well-staffed and are listened to and are given the right job to do, which sometimes they aren't, they're a really important part of our government structure.
Mike.
A couple of comments. One, just building on your statement about public lack of understanding. About 4 years ago, CBS did a poll, and it was a question of what the public understood about research. I remember sitting through Kathleen Frankovich's presentation on this. And well, one of the things they found is the public understood the relationship between research and medicine. But the relationship between research and anything else, they had absolutely no knowledge of, including economic growth, anything else. And only 10% named a single institution, that is to say, university, industry, or whatever, where research is conducted. That was a remarkable lack of understanding. Last year, though, the APS completed a report on energy efficiency, and a couple of things that came out of that that I thought was interesting. We concluded that, in fact, we don't understand human behavior well enough in the area of energy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of our primary recommendations is that the government ought to be funding more behavioral research. So building on what Neil was talking about, it, scientists getting together, it's not just right. natural scientists. The other point that I would make, though, is that sometimes scientists themselves don't know enough about policy issues. And one of the things that happened as we were preparing the report is I commented in some of the stuff I was writing that our energy, our usage of oil was only between 5 and 10% more today than it was in 1973. The other nine members of the committee who were working on this wrote back an email, you're all wrong. They had never bothered to look at the data. And that's the fact.
Yeah.
And so sometimes I think we, as scientists, think we know more than we do. And I think we have to be a little bit cautious because we go out in front of the public and say things that are not correct.
Mm-hmm.
Then we lose credibility.
I think that's absolutely right. Some years ago, when I was involved with the National Science Board, Mary Good, who's the vice chair, and I were working on a project exploring a concern I've had for a long, long time as the former editor of the Reviews of Modern Physics, that there's a lot of stuff published in our physics journals that just didn't turn out to be right. And I'm thinking now really of numerical properties of atoms and molecules and materials that where people claim they made an absolute measurement of something and they got it really out wrong. And so we weren't making much progress getting support out of the Congress for CODATA and other organizations that worry about these kind of things. And so I had the idea that we should go to the engineering community. They are the customers for this data, the handbooks that we fill with good stuff or not so good stuff. And so we went to the IEEE because I happened to know personally the guy who was in charge of their public policy activities, and said, could we cooperate with you to see if we couldn't explore the IEEE taking recognition of where they get their data from and expressing concern? I wanted them to get IEEE to publish a statement that says, you damn scientists are giving us a bunch of junk. And if engineering's gonna work, we want really good data. We want you to understand systematic errors and not just statistical ones. As I once said in my retiring APS presidency speech, God loves the noise as much as he does the signal. Keep your eyes open. And I got back, what I got back was cooperation. They agreed that they would put a little questionnaire in the next annual bill statement for IEEE. And the question was, do you believe the National Science Foundation budget for science should go up, stay the same, or go down? And 80% of the engineers said, go down. So my assumption is that the public understands that engineers do all that good stuff that's based on physics, whereas doctors, who are the same people as the biomedical scientists, do all the good stuff that's about medicine. Neither of those statements is true. And even though we do get some reflected credit off the engineers because it's always the scientists who put those robots on Mars, not the engineers that built the robots.
Or to use metrics rather than English.
Yeah, we can't blame the engineers for confusing the metric and English systems of measurement and then wrecking one satellite.
We actually owe that to Thomas Jefferson. He had an opportunity and he lost it. But anyway, let's thank all three of our speakers. Thank you.